So when we talk about the subject of death, generally two or three predominant emotions we can notice in ourselves and the people around us. Firstly, it is fear, fear of unknown, or the fear of all the things that will happen to us after death according to the beliefs that we hold. If you belong to Christian religion, then you have the fear of eternal hell. If you don't subscribe to such and such a belief and don't undergo certain rituals, then there is hell waiting for you forever and ever. There is fear. Same in the case of Islam, probably, as far as I know. I don't know whether it speaks of eternal hell, but there is some fear of hell for sure. And among the Hindus, there is a fear of the Vaisarani river, which is so terrifying, the imagery that is projected, and thinking of oneself being caught in that terrible, horrifying river full of suffering and innumerable kinds of horrifying creatures which torment the soul, and all that is quite terrifying. So fear is one thing. Sadness, of course, obviously, it is very natural for any one of us, when we lose our loved ones, to feel sad. If somebody thinks that he is a philosopher and is not feeling sad when his near and dear ones pass away, then we don't know what to say. Probably a monster. He is a monster. So especially the fear part of death is largely induced by religions. Largely induced by religion. Of course, the other part is the fear of unknown. What happens after death and all, you don't even know anything, you don't subscribe to religion, so it's a kind of blankness, annihilation. So you cling to your life as you know it, which is your life of the personality. That's a different kind of fear. The other idea that comes quite prominent in today's young urban youth is a kind of is there in this life is only what you can enjoy in this life. What is there beyond and all that doesn't matter. It's meaningless. Death and contemplation on death, meaningless. Life is here. You enjoy it. Take what you want. Grab it. Whatever means is there at your disposal, use it indiscriminately, because your object of existence is your personal happiness, and therefore you attain whatever it is, ambition. That's another aspect, another idea of death that we find very common. Such a person may be highly religious. In the current understanding of the term religious, such a person may still be religious. He may go to temple ritual, or he may do namaz 5 times a day and all that, but still he may hold these core ideas about life and death, which is that anything beyond this life is meaningless, so this life is what matters. The other thing that we find is that coming out of fear is that let's not talk about death, it's something very negative. What do they call it? These are all not good things to talk about.
Inauspicious.
Inauspicious, exactly. Exactly, that's the right word. Inauspicious. But then, if you look at any tradition, philosophical tradition, especially Indian tradition, inquiry into death is of supreme importance, paramount importance. Of the 10 principal Upanishads that we have, many of them directly deal with the topic of death and analyze it and then examine it and then see how it is relevant to life. one of the Upanishads, the Kathopanishad, is purely about death. The conversation between the child Nachiketa and the lord of death, Yama, about the mysteries of death. So it is certainly not inauspicious, certainly nothing to be afraid of, and certainly profoundly meaningful to the life that we are leading today. If death is meaningless, life is also meaningless. Life gets its meaning only because there is something at death and beyond death. Similarly, death gets its significance only because of the life that we have lived. If there is no relationship between these two, and both are complementary and mutual in providing meaning to each other, then this whole universe, this life, this human existence is but a cruel drama, chaotic, cruel drama. All these events, they lose its meaning if there is nothing before death and nothing beyond death, and if life is only this cradle to grave. So think about it. All the events that you go through, and fortune and misfortune, opportunity and lost opportunity, you cannot resolve the riddles of life unless death and what happens beyond death is understood. Look at this, the Gita, in the 13th chapter, Krishna is telling to Arjuna what constitutes true wisdom. Of the 10, 12 things that he says one important thing, that is, that this wisdom is meditation upon birth, death, decay, sickness and error. Which is prophet said this in Quran, Holy Quran. But people are all asleep. Only when they die, they are actually awake. Buddha, Lord Buddha says that somewhere in Dhammapada, to the effect that if a man believes that there is no hereafter, there is here and hereafter, right? This life and what is beyond this life. If a man believes that there is no hereafter, there is no crime that such a person will not commit. If you don't have correct understanding of what happens hereafter and think that you are only this cradle to grave phenomena, there is no crime that you will not commit. Similarly, in the Kannada great epic Kumaravyasa's Bharata, Vidura is made to say this regarding Duryodhana to Krishna. He says that this fellow Duryodhana, he doesn't know what happens after death, so he is ready to do anything. Into this effect. The correct understanding of life and death is absolutely important, because especially today, you know, in the Key to Theosophy, if you remember, we were studying, the teacher says it is because of your narrow ideas about life and death that the world is filled with crass materialism. The materialism of today is because of the wrong outlook, the wrong ideas that we have regarding man, why he is here, what happened before birth, what is this life for, what happens after death. This knowledge is missing. So if we take up some questions regarding death, some questions like these arise. What is death? What happens after it? And the dear departed ones, it may be our parents or close friends or spouse and some unfortunate case, children, where are they now? In what condition are they in? We loved them so much while they were alive. They took care of us, we took care of them. But a time came when they left us and then went somewhere. Are they happy? Can we help them? Can we communicate with them? Can we ever meet that person again and live with that person? You know, these are all burning human questions, which unfortunately, to a large extent, it is these very core human sentiments which are misused by religion. If you don't do such and such a ritual when your father or mother dies, then you read out something from the scriptures and say that this is the punishment. Your father's soul will be stuck in such and such a thing forever. Till you do this and this ritual and give dana to me, final beneficiary, whether the soul benefits or not, beneficiary is the Purohit at the end of the day. Like that, there are all religions have taken up, you know, played upon these sentiments. The fanaticism that we find today, religious fanaticism, where does it spring from? It springs on manipulation of this emotion. A person is born a devout Muslim, but he is indoctrinated with the idea that if you don't work for Prophet Muhammad's law, ensure that the kafirs, unbelievers, are removed from the face of the earth, it is a great danger for you. On the other hand, if you take up arms or do whatever is necessary in the cause of the holy jihad, then you have eternal heaven. That heaven description, which was supposed to be probably quite symbolical, but with human fancy and over the ages, if you read those descriptions of heaven and hell in Islam and Christianity, and even Indian Swarga and Narka, it is more real and vivid than the life that we are living here. So to understand all this about heaven and hell, what happens after death, without going into too much of details, broadly we have to understand the basic idea is that each one of us have two aspects. There is a mortal, temporary, time-bound aspect which is constantly changing, which is not real, which is temporary, transient. And there is a part of us which is immortal. This basic idea of the dual nature of man must be understood and studied in great detail if we want to unravel the mysteries of life and death. Without that, if you take man as one homogeneous being and especially consider it like the Asura king did in the Upanishad, consider that the body is Atman, or the body is the self in other words, then all kinds of demonoidal tendencies arise, all materialism arise from it, and we will reach nowhere close to truth or happiness or peace or contentment. So this twofold aspect of man is of primary importance. This idea is variously expressed through similes in our scriptures. The Bhagavad Gita, the very, you know, when Krishna begins to expound the great philosophy, he begins with this idea of immortality and mortality, because that's the very crux of everything, the very cornerstone of the whole edifice of true philosophy is this immortality of man and his mortal aspect. So he says, after every day you change your clothes. You don't wear the same old dirty clothes. Similarly, the real inner being changes the body and the name, the form. So he is wearing all these body emotions and feelings, the inner senses, the outer senses, all these is worn by us. That's the basic thing. The whole of the Gita rests upon that idea that man is immortal. And another example is given elsewhere, that you take the honey bee. The honey bee goes from flower to flower, gathering the very essence of that flower. It doesn't take the flower itself. The flower is left to wither, fall down, and become one with the dust, one with the earth. But the bee intelligently takes the honey from the flower. Similarly, it is said, each one of us are pilgrim souls going through this pilgrimage of life. We being birthless and deathless, eternal, unchangeable, immutable, no matter what calamity befalls on us, but the real self, your real nature remains unchanged. That being the case, we are gathering in each life through our proxy agent, his mind and the personality. Through our proxy agent, we are gathering the best that is possible from this life, which is congenial to our true divine nature. What is not congenial is left to wither and die, like the flower is left. That's another example. Third example is even more nice. Third simile. You take the case of an excellent actor. Every evening he performs in a great drama troupe. Today he is in Varanasi. He is playing the role of king. He is playing that role tonight. Excellent actor. He performs it so well that he identifies himself with the role. He acts like it, he thinks like it, he feels like it, and so on. But when the night comes and the next day begins, they have moved from Varanasi to, I don't know where, Rajasthan probably. And they have taken up another drama to play. And there, he is playing the role of a cook. But such is his nature that he involves in being a cook. And then recipe making, delicious food, is completely involved. Like that he goes from evening to evening, performing various roles. The roles keep changing. Costumes that he wears is appropriate to the role that he is playing. In Varanasi, he cannot wear the cook's dress because he is playing the king's role. Similarly here. So appropriate to that, he is wearing the costumes. But the individual, the actor himself, is changeless, isn't he? He is the one who is playing all these roles, performing all these roles. But himself changeless. He is still the same. He is still the same. Like that, our real nature, true self, we are going through various lives. This is one such incident, one such role that we have played. And trying to gather honey from it through our proxy agent. Like, you know, the landlord does not go and till the field and then gather all the harvest, because he has large tracts of land. So he sends his servant, his representative, saying that, oh, you take care of all the things, at the end of the season bring me the harvest. And this is your monthly payment. You have to bring the harvest. So that is, you know, the mortal aspect of man and the immortal aspect of man. So when we come to analyzing the mortal aspect of man, there is such important teaching given in Key to Theosophy and all. But broadly classifying, broadly speaking, body is certainly mortal. Nobody denies it. We all know body is going to die. Body is changing. From yesterday to today it has changed. From last hour to this hour it has changed. From birth to this hour, so many changes have taken place. It's going to die one day. But the mortal aspect of man is not limited to his physical body alone. The physical body subsists, is there, and retains its form and energy. It is energized because of a certain inner body. That is like an ethereal body. A substance which is not ordinarily visible to us, except in some strange circumstances, wherein we think that, oh, it is a ghoul, a pisacha, and then we get afraid of it and so on. On burial grounds and all, many people see that, a vapory kind of form. That's the invisible but still the mortal aspect of man which the real man is left and gone. Is there in us. It is through that we are using the senses. Our ability to see, touch, hear, taste, all this comes from the real senses which are residing in that, you may call it electromagnetic body. So very, very ethereal body. That is also mortal. Its lifespan is not limited to 80, 90 years, but extends far beyond, because the substance that is used to form that body is of a more ethereal kind. So its tenacity is more. plasticity is more. And thirdly, our desires, our emotions, feelings, sentiments, all the human and animal sentiments are all these three, four things are all left by us, the real self. And then we go like the bee who has gathered the honey to make it into the beehive. This is broadly the classification of man and what happens after death. The physical body is the first thing to die, and clinically he is pronounced dead, he or she is pronounced dead. But what occult philosophy says is that it's still the beginning of the process of death. Death is not an event, death is a process. It's not a one thing. It has a beginning and goes through a certain stages. Like your sleep, it has various stages. Similarly, death has various aspects. The body first dies. The first thing, the most unimportant and transitory aspect of man, first thing to leave. It is at that moment that the inner real man is busy gathering the harvest from the field which has been sown. The person has lived for 80, 90 years. Where are all those energies that he has generated life? It's all there in various parts of his being. He is gathering all that, collating all that, aggregating all that. That is the harvest he has. But if you have seen a farmer, when he harvests the food, it has the grain as well as the chaff. The farmer is interested in the grain only. The leaves, the stem and the other things is not of much use to him. So there is a threshing and winnowing that happens at the end of every season, where they separate the grain from the chaff. The whole range of experiences we have gathered in this process of death. So we review the whole life in an instant. We review the whole life, gather it, and then winnow it, thresh it, make it into two separate buckets, take the honey and go to our real state, as Brihadaranyaka Upanishad said. Our real condition is that what we did for the 80-90 years of this life was a dream actually. Most of the time we make it into a nightmare, but we can say it's a dream. And the real man wakes up with the experiences that he has gathered. What kind of experiences he has gathered? What is the kind of experiences he can take to that high state? Whatever is congenial to his nature. If each one of us are spiritual beings, then from the life that we have lived, only those experiences, feelings, acts, speech, which are of spiritual nature, impersonal, compassionate, concerned towards others, abstract, those alone can be gathered. All others are something that he is not interested in. All other things that we have done in life is so much of a burden. So much of a burden which has to be, which he has to, like Christ is made to carry the cross, right, before being crucified. Like that, the burden of cross, we have added more weight to the burden of cross that we will have to carry when we come back to life again. That's what the teachings say. So here, heaven and hell, as we saw, terrifying ideas about hell, terrifying ideas. And heaven has become an allurement to do all kinds of things to, grind our acts in terms of political considerations and so on. There is nothing known as eternal hell. Neither is there anything called as eternal heaven. Anything that has a beginning has to have an end. Can something have a beginning logically and not have an end? Philosophically and logically impossible. So in this state of, this process of death that we were discussing, where the winnowing and the separation happens, there is a kind of suffering that we undergo to separate ourselves from all the lower materialistic tendencies that we have generated. That is the basis of the fantastic ideas about health that have been generated. You know, that psycho-spiritual aspect of our death is taken, hijacked, and then formed into fantastic ideas about hell to torment you and to exploit. We are very clear in teachings are given. We will consider them if we have time. Clearly said, each person's destiny, whether in life or after death or anywhere else, is solely dependent on his own actions, his own thoughts, feelings, or speech and action. So somebody else trying to influence that, you are dead and gone, your son or somebody trying to influence your destiny there by some action here, doesn't make any sense. That is not what is thought at all. And coming to the idea that why is such a death necessary at all? Especially when we lose loved ones, dear ones. Yeah, why should there be death? Why can't we happily enjoy forever and ever company of such a nice person? Asking the question why there is death is like asking the question why is there sleep? Why should there be night and why should there be sleep? Then you imagine how your day will be if there is no sleep. By the end of the third day you will be exhausted and finished. If there is no rest after activity, completely exhausted, you won't be able to do anything. What was an enjoyment becomes a monotony. What was an enjoyment becomes so much a curse for you. Only because there is night, that day gets its significance. Only because there is death, that life gets its significance. So these are two aspects of nature. As Krishna says, light and darkness are world's eternal ways. Wherever you take, whatever aspect of nature you study, there is the dual aspects, positive and negative. Two aspects. So why is there death? Because the soul needs rest. For the one who has died, going through this process of death, for his real self, when he meets death, he is like a friend. He will welcome death as a friend. So it is said, death comes to man as a deliverer and a friend. If you study what happens to the person after death, what a blissful state. Even an averagely good person, but not talking of pious people, averagely, normal, average person, man of the world, average, have some good feelings towards his own family, few good deeds, you know. Even such a person, what kind of bliss, for how long, and uninterrupted, unalloyed, peace, contentment, happiness, long episodes of felicity and peace, to be interrupted only by still more felicity and peace and happiness, with complete obliteration of anything that is happening on earth. The very idea that there is something called pain and suffering is washed out of your soul. The very idea that there was something called as suffering, you know, this life is full of suffering, that predominantly it is oppressive. But there it is predominantly freedom. And the idea that there was something called as suffering is over a long period of time, nature washes that memory from the soul. That's why children are so happy. They come back from that high Diwali state, innocent, happy, carefree. There's a nature of, there's a real nature, peaceful, happy, contented. So if you know what happens after death, when somebody dies, of course we feel sad and all, but yeah, that's there. But then inwardly you would actually be happy that a person, my dear one, is going to such a good place. Nature has a provision to, you know, like a strict mother who punishes the soul for all the misdeeds that it did on earth. But at the same time, the mother does not only punish, she also, you know, takes care of the child and then consoles it. So there is a justice aspect, there is a compassion aspect which will compensate the soul for all the suffering. So when a person dies, he is entering that great state where he is in touch with this true divine nature, and he doesn't know what is happening on earth and all that. Just imagine if a person is a father who has left his children and his beloved wife on earth and gone into that state. Imagine if he is able to see what is happening to them on earth. Would he be happy? Would the soul be happy? Impossible. With all the changes that goes on in their life, wife will one day forget the husband, marry someone else. And then the children will call somebody else as a father. Soul does not see any of this. Once he goes into and wraps himself in that state, clothes himself in that ethereal body, he is unaware of anything that happens on earth, but the few good moments of his life, few good things that is done in the life, is taken, expanded, and then developed further, and he weaves a beautiful life for himself for a long period, which he enjoys. To become, he has to come back again, but there is respite, there is a short interval. So we are like a pendulum swinging between life and death. Eternally swinging between life and death. When we are in life, we forget all that we remembered. So this body is a river of Nide, a big mythology. This is a strange river where if you immerse yourself in it and get up, forgetfulness comes over you. Story. This body is the river of Nide. When you come back from the high state and take up another body, forgetfulness comes over you. Similarly, when we go through this whole life and go there, another kind of forgetfulness comes. Where we forget all suffering, every sin that we committed, everything is left here. It's all waiting for the person to come back and resume. They're all arranging hounds, wolves, they're all waiting, all the sins that he has committed is waiting for the moment that he is going to come back, envelop him, and then dictate his tendencies, affect him, bring back the results of his actions. The things that we can speak of, discuss about, but we'll stop here, and if opportunity arises, we can consider things like near-death experiences. There's one Louisiana radio oncologist. From 1998 onwards, he has collected more than 1,000 near-death experiences and then categorized them, analyzed them, found out what is common amongst all these. So we can consider all that, but we will take up any questions.
In the Garuda Purana, there are 35 cases that you have said. But at the same time, the very good medicine you have said to him. But there is clear evidence that it is in temporary.
Temporary.
You use care. So what can this animal soul learn?
Okay.